How can a microchip manufacturer keep track of 250 million control points at once?
How can technology behind animated movies help enterprises reimagine their future?
Built for Change listeners know those answers and more. I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein. We're the hosts of Built for Change, a podcast from Accenture.
We talk to leaders of the world's biggest companies to hear how they've reinvented their business to create industry-shifting impact.
And how you can, too.
New episodes are coming soon, so check out Built for Change wherever you get your podcasts.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, and then there were nine. Justice Neil Gorsuch shows up for his first day on the Supreme Court, and he's not shy about it. And why would a democratic country voluntarily choose to make itself more authoritarian? A view from the referendum in Turkey. It's Tuesday, April 18th. Adam, were you in the room today with Justice Gorsuch?
I was. I watched him through 3 hours of arguments in three different cases.
Wow, that's endurance.
It sure was.
Adam Liptak is our Supreme Court reporter. All right, so give us the scene on this first day for the newest Supreme Court justice.
So for more than a year, we've had eight chairs behind the Supreme Court bench. Today, there's a ninth one on the far right.
Right.
And Justice Gorsuch comes in, strikingly tall, towering over Justice Sotomayor, takes his seat. Chief Justice Roberts welcomes him in a sort of formal way, wishing him good luck and a long career in what the Chief Justice called their common endeavor. And Justice Gorsuch said a couple of nice words in response about how warmly his colleagues had welcomed him. And then we were off into the first of three very minor technical arguments.
All right, so tell me about the case, or I guess cases, that Judge Gorsuch and these eight other judges were hearing.
Well, one involved where you file civil service complaints, another about what you have to establish for standing for the right to sue if you're intervening in someone else's lawsuit. And the third one involved statutes of limitations in securities cases. They were all boring as hell, and I'm not sure I would have gone to any of them, except that we had a new justice on the bench.
So, Adam, with all of those very sexy cases in mind, what did Justice Gorsuch actually do today?
He talked a lot. He was a very active questioner. He had, although he's just been sworn in, he was fully up to speed on, and I'm not kidding, unbelievably complicated cases. Cases so complicated that Justice Alito, who's a very able lawyer, said, "Who wrote these statutes? Someone who enjoys picking wings off of flies?" But Justice Gorsuch, he had no opening day jitters. At times, he apologized for talking so much. And whatever the context, in all three arguments, he pressed one theme, which is, let's just look at the words of the statute. Let's look at the words Congress voted for. We don't care about what their thinking was, what the history of it was, what the consequences of it were, what the policy upshot of a particular interpretation is. If the words are stupid, we're going to follow the Congress right off a cliff. And he made this point in half a dozen different ways throughout all three cases.
All right. So, Adam, as someone who has seen many first days in the Supreme Court before, do you see any motive in these debuts, kind of how they get pulled off?
I suppose it's possible. What's more common is that they're shy and they've planned out like one question they're going to ask somewhere in the course of the day. Some of them don't ask a question until their second or third day. What we saw here, I don't think was motive, but personality. He's very at ease with the setting. He's super self-confident. He enjoys it. He really attacked these little cases with relish. And if this is what he's like on day one at 49 years old, on day 5,000 and 10,000, he is going to be a justice who will leave a major impact. Also because he has very strongly held views. They don't so far skew ideologically, but they definitely skew in terms of interpretation. We've seen this now in three statutory cases. That's about half the court's docket.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen him yet in a constitutional case where the text is a little more open-ended, and that's where some values tend to bleed into the judging. So that will be the next hurdle, and we'll see that probably on Wednesday in a big separation of church and state case. So then we'll see another side of him. But, I mean, listen, he will probably take the same attitude toward the Constitution as he does to statutes, which is to say, what do the words mean? Do the words allow me to impose my views? And he's probably in the constitutional setting going to read the words narrowly and not be a proponent of, say, abortion rights or gay rights, because he's going to say he can't find those words in the Constitution.
Okay, Adam, the last time we talked, Gorsuch was still in the middle of this brutal nomination battle that ultimately involved changing the rules of the Senate to get him on the court. Was there any evidence in the room today of that battle kind of lingering on?
To the contrary, what the court seemed to want to do, what Chief Justice Roberts definitely wanted to do, was put that all behind them. They're sick of being in the spotlight. They don't like being portrayed as political. They want to go about their business. And the whole tone and tenor of today was, we're back in business. Whatever happened over the past 14 months is history. There are nine of us now, and we're going to try to go back to our usual role, which is, they hope, to be a respected, independent branch of the government, untainted by the brutal political battle that just happened.
So one last thing before we go. You've also been reporting on a new study about the workings of the Supreme Court. Is there anything we should know about that study in light of this being Gorsuch's first day on the court?
Well, what the study shows is that the more conservative justices interrupt the more liberal ones much more often than the other way around.
Fascinating.
And that the male justices interrupt the female ones at hugely disproportional rates, and it very seldom happens the other way around. I'm not going to start out my coverage of Justice Gorsuch by accusing him of falling into those camps.
Fair.
But nor is it out of the question that being conservative and being male might cause him to be a little more aggressive than some of his counterparts.
You're saying Judge Gorsuch is a potentially strong candidate for interruption.
But we don't have the data yet, Michael. But the early indications are that it's at least possible.
Adam, thank you as always. A pleasure. We'll talk soon.
Great to be here.
Bye. We'll be right back.
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for The New York Times, covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating to these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check. Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
After a failed coup attempt in July, the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has aggressively protected his already vast power by purging his perceived enemies. He's arrested tens of thousands of people, removed tens of thousands more from their jobs, shut down more than 100 media organizations, and as my colleague Patrick Kinsley has been reporting, the list goes on.
Well, he has cracked down hard on most forms of opposition. He's locked up the two leaders of the third largest opposition party in parliament. He has opened thousands of cases against people who are perceived to have insulted him in the media, mm-hmm. or on Twitter, in newspapers. This is someone that people fear takes things very personally and will put up with no dissent whatsoever.
Nevertheless, on Sunday, voters in Turkey decided by a very narrow margin to give President Erdogan more power. So, Patrick, what did this referendum on Sunday actually do?
Well, it did two things. One, it meant that from 2019, whoever wins the presidential election in that year will officially be able to be the executive president of Turkey. They'll be the head of the government. They'll have extraordinary sweeping powers. They'll be able to appoint key judges. They'll be able to set the budget. And unlike in the US, the parliament won't have much control over that budget. But implicitly, the referendum did something else, which is to validate President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's de facto authoritarian rule. He's been the president since 2014 mm-hmm. in a role that currently is not supposed to be particularly powerful, but he's been running the country as if he is the executive president.
So you mentioned parliament. Help me understand what the government is that this referendum is going to now replace.
So parliament at the moment is controlled by President Erdogan's party, and it has a prime minister who is nominally the head of the government. What the referendum does is eradicate the position of prime minister so that the president is the sole executive power in the country.
All right. So with all of this in mind, Patrick, what kind of a person in Turkey supported this referendum, giving Erdogan so much more power?
So a simplistic explanation of Turkish history is one of a secular elite dominating mm-hmm. pious sections of the population, marginalizing pious sections of the population, and one that controlled religion and also isolated religious people from public life. The vast majority of people are Muslim, followers of Islam. And Mr. Erdogan represents the final coming to power of this pious majority or the pious sections of the population. And to generalize slightly, the kind of person that would feel good about supporting the referendum would be perhaps someone that comes from that section of society that was historically marginalized, someone who feels that Erdogan isn't someone who's infringing on democratic freedoms, but actually someone who's upholding one of the most important democratic freedoms of all, which is freedom of religion.
Right.
And then there were more material reasons why the country is slightly in chaos. There was the failed coup last year that was a genuine threat to the government. You've got two different terrorism campaigns, one run by Kurdish nationalists, the other run by the Islamic State. Over the border in Syria, there's the Syrian civil war going on, and that has in turn spilled over into Turkey in the form of the Syrian refugee crisis. There were more refugees in Turkey than in any other country, 3 million. And all of this creates a lot of instability. And I think people perhaps naturally feel that it's better to have a strong centralized presidency that can control and try and manage all these different crises. And that's why people are seemingly happy to give up their democratic freedoms to do so.
So, Patrick, you've covered this referendum the entire time up until the vote on Sunday. Was this a fair election from what you can tell?
Well, there's two things we have to analyze here. The first is, was the actual vote fair? Mm-hmm. And was the campaign fair? The vote is being contested. The opposition says that there was ballot box stuffing going on. And there are certainly at least three videos that we've seen that suggest that there is some ballot box stuffing going on. Whether it's to the extent that the opposition says, we don't know. And what we can definitely say is that, objectively speaking, the campaign was, as one election observer put it today, conducted on a very unlevel playing field. The Yes campaign, Mr. Erdogan's campaign, had every access to state resources, to public media, and also private media, who've been cowed by this extraordinary crackdown that's taken place over the last few years against opposition outlets. And campaigners who I've interviewed have said that, you know, they've been shot at, they've been beaten, they've even been stabbed. Who attacked them, we can't say exactly, but certainly there was an atmosphere of intimidation. Mr. Erdogan certainly, and his allies certainly, in their speeches, equated people who voted no to terrorists. And so there's a real atmosphere of intimidation, and it's an environment in which people are wary of speaking out and perhaps wary of even voting against the president. So we can definitely say the campaign was not fair, and we can also add that there are allegations of voter fraud, but these have yet to be proved.
I just want to zoom out for a minute, because before I started this interview with you, I went online and just reminded myself of exactly where Turkey is. And it is smack dab in the middle of Europe and the Middle East. And we talk a lot on the show about the politics of Europe right now and the rise of far-right political figures who have grave concerns about Islam. And then we have a Middle East in which there is the rise of a more radical form of Islam. And in Erdogan, there's this kind of interesting figure of a far-right candidate and someone who wants there to be more public Islam in his country. Is that right? And how are we to make sense of that?
He's quite a confusing figure because he's not a typical Islamist that one could compare, for example, to the Islamists that I've interviewed and known in Egypt, where I used to be based. In Egypt, for example, the main Islamist party, the Muslim Brotherhood, its members talked in terms of Sharia law. It had no unveiled women within the ranks of its political wing. Whereas if you go to Turkey, you will, for example, find unveiled women who are MPs for Mr. Erdogan's party. Mm. You'll never hear them talking in terms of Sharia law. Mr. Erdogan, for example, at a rally that I attended a couple of weeks ago, was praising both unveiled and veiled women, and he made a point of saying that. And he's also operating within what is still a fairly secular country. So while he does, yes, talk about wanting to create a more pious generation of Turks, and yes, he's an authoritarian leader, but he's not necessarily a theocrat.
Patrick, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
On Monday, President Trump called President Erdogan to congratulate him on the results of the referendum. The Daily will be covering the broader implications of the referendum for the United States and the rest of the world in the coming days. Here's what else you need to know today.
Just in the past 2 weeks, the world witnessed the strength and resolve of our new president in actions taken in Syria and Afghanistan. North Korea would do well not to test his resolve or the strength of the armed forces of the United States in this region.
On the second day of his 10-day trip to Asia, Vice President Mike Pence is talking tough to North Korea, but also,
we hope to achieve this objective through peaceful means.
Not ruling out the possibility of diplomatic talks between the Trump administration and the regime of Kim Jong-un to slow or stop North Korea's nuclear weapons program. And in an interview with The Times, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said he's looking for his next job.
You know, I want to have fun and I want to make money. You know, if I'm not going to be in public service, then I want to make money.
Over the past year, Christie dropped out of the presidential campaign, failed to land a position in the Trump administration, and returned to a state where just 20% of voters approve of his performance as governor.
My OPIT will be fine. I'm not worried about that. The first graph of my OPIT will be pretty good. And my children and hopefully someday grandchildren will be able to read it and go, okay, Grandpa lived a life of consequence. That'd be good.
His second and final term in office will end later this year. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.